Welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. This month, we find out how the menstrual cycle influences competition and cooperation and why women's sexual interest takes a nosedive after childbirth. We also ask the question, what do we get out of a cuddle? This is the October edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk.
It's very sweet. Good night.
What are you doing? Having a nice snuggle here.
I know, but your snuggle always leads to sex.
So what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't it lead to sex?
Well, sometimes you just want to snuggle and you don't want to have sex.
What's the advantage of that?
Because it's nice. You connect and it's warm and sweet and...
Okay, let's just snuggle. Come on.
You can do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Without it turning into something?
Yeah, we'll just snuggle.
It's sweet.
In this clip from the sitcom Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry and Cheryl disagree about the point of cuddling. It might be an integral part of a physical relationship, but should a cuddle be sexual, or instead, should it be what we might term nurturant, a behaviour that builds a non-sexual feeling of closeness? The fact is, it's not just Larry and Cheryl who disagree. Psychologists do too. We know from past research that testosterone levels increase in response to sexual experiences, but they decrease when we engage in nurturant behaviours. This may help to limit aggressive behaviour and promote friendliness. For example, when a man spends time with his children, his testosterone levels go down because playing catch with Junior is clearly a nurturant behaviour. But cuddling is peculiar because although it's often perceived as a nurturant behaviour, it boosts testosterone, just as we'd expect if it was a sexual behaviour. So is cuddling just a form of foreplay, and do men and women really have different ideas about the purpose of cuddling? Sari Van Anders and her colleagues at the University of Michigan decided to clear up these questions once and for all by asking over 500 men and women all about cuddling. How often they did it, for how long, what else they did whilst cuddling, and how they felt about it. The results of the study were pretty surprising. First of all, participants in the study reported cuddling with their partners for an average of 47 minutes at a time, 4.5 nights, and 3.4 mornings per week. That's more than 6 hours of cuddling every 7 days. It's a wonder we find time for anything else. But it seems that cuddling is a favourite pastime of multitaskers because whilst cuddling, 66% of people said they watched TV, 28% said they talked with their partner, and 14% said they read. 18% of people said they slept whilst cuddling, which does seem to be cheating. Are you really cuddling someone if you're both unconscious? It's hardly quality time, is it? The researchers found that the majority of respondents reported equal initiation of cuddling, so it seems neither sex is more eager for physical contact, despite the common perception that women are more into cuddling than men. But do men and women want to cuddle for different reasons? Again, it seems not. The majority of respondents of both sexes said they cuddled to feel close to their partner or to show affection. Sounds more nurturant than sexual. Although, perhaps, like Larry, men are protesting too much. They claim they're interested only in intimacy, before revealing that they're really using the cuddle as a stepping stone to sex. Well, it's only a theory. Either way, Van Anders showed that sex followed nearly half of all cuddling episodes. It may or may not be the man who suggests sex, but it's clear that somebody's suggesting it, because it's happening 50% of the time. Interestingly, even though there was no difference between men and women in terms of the likelihood that cuddling would precede sex, the researchers found that straight couples were more likely to graduate to sex than gay couples, who, it seems, are more content to cuddle for cuddling's sake. Why this might be, we're not yet sure. Overall, it seems that cuddling is perceived as nurturant, but experienced as sexual, which might explain why it boosts testosterone. So, when you snuggle up with your partner on the sofa to watch TV, you might not be thinking about sex. But your brain is. Your filthy, dirty brain. After giving birth, about a third of women report a reduction in sexual desire that can last as long as 6 months and, in some cases, even a year. What's behind this lack of interest in sex, apart from the probably justified fear of getting knocked up for a second time and having to squeeze another fetus out of your special area? There are obvious physical reasons, such as incontinence and prolapse, of which I, as a man, would prefer to remain blissfully and selfishly ignorant until they carry me off in a box. But research suggests that psychological factors might outweigh the physical when it comes to a reluctance to resume normal service between the sheets. So what might these psychological factors be? Brain imaging has shown that childbirth is associated with changes in the amygdala, a region of the brain implicated in emotion. This may increase maternal feelings towards the infant, and, with your brain fully focused on baby, bedroom antics inevitably take a backseat. But the amygdala also has a role to play in sexual arousal, so the picture isn't as clear as we might think. Heather Rupp of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University got together a group of heterosexual women. 30 of these women had never had kids. Another 30 had popped at least one sprog, who was 3 to 6 months old at the time of testing. Inside the fMRI scanner, the women viewed three sets of images. Images of infants, sexually explicit images, and images with neutral content. Afterwards, the women viewed the same images again on a laptop and rated how aroused each image made them feel. It was explained to the women that arousal shouldn't be taken to mean sexual arousal per se, but rather the strength of any emotion aroused by the image. Using this definition of arousal, a picture of a cute baby, a mountain scene, or some hardcore sexual loving could all be classed as arousing. Generally, the sexual images were rated as more arousing than the baby images, and the baby images as more arousing than the neutral images. However, although non-mothers found the sexual images more arousing than the baby images, mothers found sexual and baby images equally arousing. The brain scans indicated that non-mothers had a stronger response in their amygdala to all three types of stimulus, compared to the mothers. Because of this, Rupp suggested that decreases in mothers' self-reported feelings of sexual desire are related to a general decrease in amygdala activation, rather than a change in brain function that's specifically related to sex. Because mothers had a general decrease in activation to stimuli of all kinds, it can't be that they're redirecting attention away from sex and towards their infant. If this was the case, we'd expect to see mothers experiencing greater brain activation in response to infant stimuli than non-mothers, which we don't. One possible explanation for the results is that because caring for infants is particularly stressful, the amygdala becomes less responsive to stimuli of all kinds after a woman gives birth, therefore protecting against the effects of stress. If it's more difficult to become aroused by any stimulus, it's less likely you'll go crazy when baby starts crying at the checkout counter during the big shop. But this generalized dip in arousal has the side effect of turning you off sex as well. Thanks a lot, kids. Humans are naturally competitive, but our appetite for competition varies according to circumstances. Sometimes we maximise benefits to ourselves by being cooperative, and deciding whether to cooperate or compete can depend on who we interact with and when we interact with them. Marjorie Lucas and Alyssa Koff of Wellesley College in Massachusetts suggested this month that most of the research done on cooperation and competition has focused on how people seek to maximise their gains during interactions. For example, if you're playing poker, your aim should be to win as many hands as possible so that you take all your opponent's money. However, Lucas and Koff point out that we may also subordinate these aims in favour of mating motives. In other words, if I cooperate or if I compete in an economic game, a game in which one player wins resources at the expense of another, like poker, will I increase or decrease my options in the mating market? It's almost as if there's a subplot to any cooperation or competitive interaction. Lucas and Koff predicted that if mating motives influence behaviour in economic games, we might expect to see women play differently according to where they are in their menstrual cycle. I've covered the effect of the cycle on women's mate preferences many times before in the podcast, so I won't repeat myself here. If you want to know more, you can Google ovulatory shift hypothesis, or you can head over to the podcast archive at psychologyofattractivenesspodcast.blogspot.co.uk and click on the Human Easterus tag to listen to episodes about the shift. In a nutshell, women tend to be more interested in physically attractive men around the time of ovulation. This is because it's around ovulation when women can become pregnant, and so it's the only time they can take advantage of the genetic benefits of sleeping with genetically superior men, by passing those superior genes onto their offspring. So, the logic goes, if mating motives influence women's behaviour, when they're ovulating, they should cooperate more with attractive men, and less with other attractive women. 40 women visited Lucas and Koff's lab. Half of these women were in the fertile phase of their cycles, around ovulation, and the rest were in the non-fertile phase of the cycle, a few days after ovulation. The women played a series of economic games on a computer. They were told that they'd be playing these games against another person who was currently at a computer in a different city. The opponent's photograph was shown on screen. Now, in reality, the opponents weren't real, and their game behaviour was pre-programmed by the researchers. The photographs of the opponents that appeared on screen were sometimes attractive and sometimes unattractive. Half were male, and the remaining half were female. The women played an economic game with these fake opponents called the ultimatum game. In this game, the women were asked to state how much of a $20 stake they proposed splitting with their opponent. For example, they could suggest the opponent took $10, leaving the remaining $10 for themselves. Or they could be generous and offer the opponent a larger share of the $20, or be mean and keep a larger share for themselves. Then, the imaginary opponent chose to accept or reject the offer. The idea of the game is that if the second player rejects the offer, neither of you get anything. But if the second player agrees, both players get the stakes that the first player proposed. So if you decided you wanted to offer $2 of the $20 to your opponent and they said no, well, you wouldn't get the $18 that you thought you deserved. You'd get nothing. If, on the other hand, your opponent thought $2 was a great offer, then they'd get their $2 and you'd get your $18. The women were then asked to play the role of player 2 in the ultimatum game by stating the lowest offer they would accept from their opponent. The result of the experiment showed that if women were in the fertile phase of their cycle, they made lower offers to attractive women than unattractive women. Fertile women, on average, offered attractive opponents $7.75 out of the 20, and they offered unattractive opponents $10.25, $2.50 more. This makes sense if women are primed to feel more competitive with other women who are likely to act as love rivals. Attractive women might have a better chance of gazumping that man you are after, so it makes sense to diddle them out of the cash. They don't deserve a big share of the money, those love rats. And unattractive opponents? Well, fertile women were happy to give them a fairer share. Unattractive women don't make very threatening rivals, so why deny them an equal split of the cash? You might be wondering why denying a rival a share of a $20 prize pot would make a difference when it comes to competing for partners. So you've ensured your rival has fewer dollars in her purse. So what? Well, previous research by Christina Geranti and colleagues has proven that when women are ovulating, they spend more money on makeup and revealing clothing. So if you keep more money to yourself, then you can spend it on stuff that might make you more alluring to men. Meanwhile, the opponent you cheated out of her fair share won't have enough to spring for a supermarket own brand lipstick and a pair of sloggy knickers. Women also behaved more cooperatively with attractive than with unattractive men, offering more money and expressing a greater willingness to accept ungenerous offers from attractive male opponents. In the ultimatum game, attractive men were offered around $9.75, but unattractive men apparently deserved a full $2 less. Fertility status had no effect on women's offers when their opponents were male, suggesting that women operate under a general rule to be more cooperative with attractive men at all times. Apparently, you don't need to be fertile to recognise the importance of making a good impression. Do you know what? Forget splitting cash. I'm going to stick with cuddles. They're cheaper, and there's a 50% chance it'll end in sex. Win-win. That's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to www.oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris.
Okay,
what
are you doing?
What?
What am I talking about?
What? What's the problem? The ass is part of my snuggle.
No, it's not.
It is.
Okay, then good night. We'll snuggle another time.
It's just a lever. I'm using the ass as a lever to draw you in. That's all. And it gets the snuggle tighter.
Good night.